The headlines: the death toll from relentless Israeli offensive on Gaza tops 230 Palestinians target Israeli sites in retaliatory rocket attacks. President Hassan Rouhani assures that all sanctions against Iran will be removed before his term ends. And at least 9 civilians are killed as their vehicle hit a roadside bomb in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province. Hello and welcome, everybody. Israeli forces have conducted new strikes on the Gaza Strip on the 11th day of the regime's aggression against the besieged territory. 4 people were killed and 20 wounded, including 4 children, in airstrikes and artillery attacks on Khan Yunis, Gaza City, and a Palestinian refugee camp in central Gaza. Israeli warplanes also bombarded a site belonging to a resistance group near the same camp. Moreover, artillery shells rained down on the city of Rafah, in the southern Gaza Strip. Agricultural land was also bombed in Khan Yunis. As many as 231 people have been killed since Israel launched its onslaught on the Gaza Strip on May the 10th. Nearly half of the victims are women and children. So far, over 1,500 Palestinians have also been injured and more than 52,000 displaced. Palestinian resistance groups have hit more locations in Israel in retaliation for the regime's relentless onslaught on the Gaza Strip. The Hamas military wing, Al-Qassam Brigades, targeted 2 Israeli military bases of Mishmar, Hanagev, and Salam with missiles. It also fired mortar shells at the Mars military site while hitting a bus transporting soldiers near the Zikim base. 1 Israeli soldier was injured in the bus attack. Resistance groups have also hit the settlement of Nirim. In the past days, Palestinian resistance groups have conducted rocket attacks and several locations in Israel, including Tel Aviv. The groups have promised more attacks if Israel does not stop its airstrikes on Gaza. A dozen Israelis have so far been killed in the Palestinian retaliatory attacks. We'll offer us further insight on the ongoing Israeli aggression against Palestinians, both in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. We're now joined by head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Mr. Masoud Shajadeh, who's joining us from London. Also, we have political analyst Mohsen Saleh joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Let's start off with Mr. Saleh in Beirut. Sir, give us your thoughts on how events have been transpiring. It's day 11 of the Israeli onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip, and still no international intervention or action to stop the bloodshed.
Well, hi to you and the audiences and the freedom fighters in Gaza and the West Bank and other places in occupied Palestine. I guess the Israelis put themselves in one of the historical dilemmas and enigmas in their history. And I guess the Palestinians' resistance could defeat the Israelis for the first time, a fatal defeat for the Israelis. And now they are trying to find a way to escape this war. But unfortunate for them is that most of the international community and the Palestinians and the Arabs and the Muslims, the free people in the whole world, they are against this apartheid regime and this discriminatory regime and this really the most racist regime in the whole world. Now, Palestine occupied. No other land in the whole world is occupied like in Palestine. Now the Palestinians, they have to fight and in order to liberate their land and liberate their people. And they I guess, and also most of the freedom fighters in this whole world, I guess the Islamic and the Palestinian resistance in Palestine, they have achieved a victory for probably for the first time in 73 years. spiritually, materially, on the ground, they have achieved everything, and the Israelis, they lost the battle. And they lost part of their existence, and great part, especially psychologically, they have been defeated.
Masoud Shajara in London, I'd like to get your perspective on the 11 days of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Prior to that also, the Israeli aggression, the forceful evictions that were taking place in the occupied West Bank. Human Rights Watch has already been very clear about Israeli actions, stating that whatever they're doing against the Palestinians, the rights violations and so on and so forth, constitutes acts of apartheid. Need I not remind the audience of South Africa, apartheid needs international reaction and international intervention for it to stop. Why aren't we seeing that when it comes to the Israeli regime?
Well, the picture is now more clear than ever before. The reality is that, yes, it's an apartheid. Yes, war crimes are taking place. Yes, this illegal occupation is so brutal, which is unbelievable, and it's been going on not just the last few weeks, but these atrocities are committed day in, day out for the over last 70 years. These are realities. But unfortunately, at the same time, there's a reality that international community, especially the Western powers under the auspice of United States and Europe, Britain and elsewhere, are deliberately blind to these realities, deliberately supporting the atrocities being committed, either by silence or by just turning around and saying these people have got the right of defending themselves. You know, what about the Palestinians? What is their right of defending themselves? What is their right of standing and fighting against illegal occupation and the brutal ethnic cleansing and the sort of genocidal act and the apartheid system? This is the crunch of the matter. As long as these powers are appeasing those who are committing crimes, war crimes and genocidal act and indeed apartheid system, we are going to see a further escalation. And this is how the Zionist state actually counts on the fact that, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 months down the road, they're still going to get those support. They're still going to get the arms being poured in. They're still going to get the financial support to continue these barbaric acts. But at the same time, I think what is really not clear is that the international community, ordinary people around the world, have woken up in a way that they have never done before. One, and secondly, that resistance doesn't have to throw stones. The resistance is in a position to use sophisticated rockets. And so therefore, really, this match is changing its position. And the Israelis are finding that they are not able to abuse people in the same level that they have done over the last 70 years.
All right, thanks a lot, political analyst Mohsen Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, thanks to head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajara, joining us from the British capital, London. That wraps up this segment of the program. Continuing with the news, fresh protests have been held in several countries against the ongoing deadly Israeli aggression against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Thousands of people in Mauritania took to the streets to denounce the Israeli violence. Tunisian demonstrators also marched through the country's capital to voice their support for Palestinians. Similar rallies were held in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and the southwestern Yemeni city of Taiz. In Kuwait, protesters gathered in Kuwait City and slammed any normalization with the Israeli regime. Kuwaiti political activists at the rally slammed Israel for killing Palestinian women and children. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal, the JCPOA, say significant progress has been made after a fourth round of talks in Vienna, but that key issues remain unresolved. Our correspondent Tomaleski reports from Vienna.
A fourth round of talks to revive the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, concludes in Vienna, with delegations headed back home for further consultations. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said there'd been substantial progress in the past 10 days, but there were still issues that needed to be worked on. Mora said he believed an agreement was possible before Iran's presidential elections next month.
I will not venture a date because you never know, but I'm quite sure that there will be a final agreement, yeah, not far from here.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the issues that needed resolution were difficult.
Some delegations believe that the next round could be the last round. I cannot say that indefinitely, but because we are not there, we are still not there. But I think that if the other side, especially the U.S. side, can make their difficult decisions, we might be able to come to the conclusion next time we meet here in Vienna.
Araghchi said Iran is standing firm on its position that the U.S. needs to fully lift all sanctions in a verifiable manner before Tehran can take action to come back to full compliance with the JCPOA. Reports indicate that though the U.S. has agreed to ease sanctions on various sectors like energy, banking, shipping, and insurance, there are still differences on sanctioned individuals and entities, including Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. Questions have also been lingering on the fate of Iran's advanced centrifuges and whether the U.S. sanctions will be fully removed or temporarily eased. The sides have decided to meet again next week. Homal Ezgib, Vienna.
At least 9 people have been killed after a roadside bomb ripped through a vehicle in southern Afghanistan. The explosion happened in the capital of southern Helmand province. Local officials say the victims include women and children. There's been no report on the number of injuries yet. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack either. However, Taliban militants and Afghan government forces regularly clash in the region. Violence has been on the rise in the war-torn country in recent weeks. On May the 8th, a bomb explosion outside a school killed 85 people, many of them young girls. Well, our correspondent Amin Alami is joining us now from the Afghan capital, Kabul, to bring us up to speed on the recent blast that took place in southern Helmand province. I mean, what details do you have to share with us?
Well, Badia, according to local sources in southern Helmand province of Afghanistan, 9 civilians, including women and children, were died after their vehicle was hit by a roadside bomb blast in outskirts of Lashkargah, the capital city of Helmand province. Despite none of terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban, has claimed responsibility for this recent deadly bomb blast in Helmand province, but Afghan security sources blame the Taliban for launching such attacks because, according to Afghanistan's acting defense minister, an increase in bombings and targeted attacks by the Taliban across Afghanistan is because, according to this top military figure, the Taliban cannot resist against Afghan military operations across this country. But this comes while the Taliban militants captured a key district in eastern Lahman province of Afghanistan. Military sources again here in Kabul say that Afghan armed forces have retreated from this key district in eastern Lahman province of Afghanistan, but local forces there say that some of Afghan national police forces have even surrendered to the Taliban after days of fighting with these militants there. In the meantime, according to local sources in western Afghanistan, at least 4 members of a family were killed in a similar incident that happened in Helmand province. I mean, another roadside bomb blast claimed the lives of 4 members of a family in Ghor province. In another incident, unarmed men gunned down 3 Shia shopkeepers who were heading to their homes from Ghor province, from Herat province to Ghor province. According to local sources, mainly the provincial council of Ghor province, these three shopkeepers were gunned down on the Herat Ghor highway. No one has also claimed responsibility for this attack. In the meantime, Afghan military, top military commanders in northern Afghanistan also say that the Afghan armed forces, especially the commander units of Afghan army, have successfully pushed back the Taliban from some of key districts across this province in northern Afghanistan. They say that Taliban have tolerated heavy casualties over the past over the last 24 hours. According to a statement released by Afghanistan's defense ministry, a number of over 160 Taliban militants were killed during the military operations conducted by Afghan forces. And finally, this is important also to realize that Habiba Sarabi, one of the key members of Afghan negotiator team, recently said that the Taliban has declared its readiness to resume a meaningful negotiation with the Afghan side in order to bring peace and stability. But what is important is that the people of Afghanistan want an urgent ceasefire and an end to their misery, especially because a number of over 80 defenseless and innocent school students were died in three back-to-back blasts just in a few over the last few days here in the Afghan capital, Kabul.
All right, thanks a lot. Amin Alami joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "Whoever gets a brother in Allah in addition to faith in Allah and faithfulness to his brotherhood seeking Allah's pleasure, gets a ray from Allah's light, safety from the punishment of Allah, a pilgrimage to Mecca through which he will be successful on the Day of Judgment, everlasting honor and increasing reputation. That is because the believer is neither mausul nor mafsul from Allah, the Great Almighty." He was asked, "What is the meaning of mausul and mafsul?" Imam Baqir, peace be upon him, replied, "Mausul meaning the believer is not connected to Allah, mafsul meaning the believer is not separated from Allah."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam Baqir alayhi salam has a very great and beautiful conversations with his companions and with the people in general. We find that he talks about a whole host of things, whether it is history or the Quran, or it is ethics, philosophy, theology, you name it, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam talked about it with his companions. And so in one of these conversations which occurs between Imam al-Baqir and his companions, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, talks about certain bad qualities and certain evil deeds that are considered to be so in Islam and in Islamic ethics. And it is very interesting, but when the companions of Imam al-Baqir ask him about certain bad qualities and specific bad qualities, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he warns the Muslims in the following manner. He gives them this precautionary advice. He says, one of the bad qualities is to have audacity when having power and to be greedy during poverty. These two seem to be polar opposites to each other, and so it's interesting that in reply to this question in this conversation, Imam al-Baqir brings up these two seemingly polar opposites in one statement, Allahu Akbar. So one is power, and the polar opposite of power is poverty. Now he says that it is an evil thing to do, it is a bad quality. If one is audacious, bold, arrogant, proud, when one attains power. And so in reality, when we have power, whether it is the power in a family, such as the father or a brother or a mother or a older sister, this power, or for example in the workplace, the power of the boss over the employee, this power that we attain should not result in us becoming audacious or bold or arrogant or proud. Because as Imam al-Baqir says, it is a bad quality to be audacious and arrogant when having power. And then he talks about the polar opposite, which is poverty. Now, when one is poor or one is facing poverty, one should not be greedy. It is interesting, but when one is facing poverty and they lose self-control, they become greedy, meaning they're just looking everywhere to try to gain something, to try to remove this poverty. Now, it's not being said here that one shouldn't do anything to remove one's poverty. No, you should work hard. You should go and try to earn a living. You should put forth a good effort, a righteous effort in trying to take yourself out of poverty, and then Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, helps you the rest of the way. But the key point is to not be greedy in taking yourself out of poverty. Beautiful golden words in this golden conversation, in this dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I want you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
When we say Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is alim, ilm, we think, okay, ilm means library, books, terminologies, this and that and the other, that is ilm. This is worldly thing. This is like a blind person is trying to imagine, oh, so he's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala alim like that. It is above that. It is really to see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and say he is alim. That is the knowledge of the ayatul muhkamat. To really witness that. Do I worship Allah that I don't see? Amirul Mumineen said. The Sufi says you will see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the day of judgment. Imam Sadiq says that how can they see on the day of judgment? We see Allah now. Where are we? What happened to us? Why are we not challenging? Why are we not looking into this jalal wa jamal of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the knowledge that is there? We are just satisfied. They say minbar is no longer, unfortunately, a place where we could seek knowledge. Minbar has been the source of knowledge and it should be the source. We want different types and different styles. Yes, it's good for a change. But this is because the people are, it's a comfort zone. They are just happy. Just sit here, listen and leave. That's it. You know, they say, the Prophet says, when you meet an alim, you have met me. When you sit with an alim, you have sat with me. When you ask an alim, you have asked me. Yes, there are different darajat and levels. Everybody have their own limitations, right? Then as it goes, there's this ayatul muhkamat in which you talk about the malakut, the angels. What type of creation they are, what types of being they are.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Last Days in Vietnam, directed by Rory Kennedy. And joining me in the studio, we have Dave Calhoun, who is a film critic with Time Out magazine. And beside him is Lindsay German, who is the founding member and convener of the British anti-war organization Stop the War Coalition. Now, Last Days in Vietnam examines the chaotic final days of the US's presence in Vietnam and their efforts to help evacuate 135,000 South Vietnamese people as the North Vietnamese forces were closing in on Saigon. Featuring contemporary reflections from those who were there, this documentary also shows the moral dilemmas faced by US soldiers and diplomats during the unsanctioned evacuation.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam. We have adopted a plan for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces. We are finally bringing American men home.
The American troops were gone, and as a result, the House of Cards began to collapse.
We were dealing with an ambassador who was just convinced that somehow there wouldn't have to be an evacuation, and therefore there wouldn't have to be a concern about evacuating South Vietnamese.
These people were dead men walking. Sometimes there's an issue not of legal and illegal, but right or wrong. I borrowed a truck, and I drove them to the airbase. And I had told them, when you hear three thumps, that means hold the baby's mouths, don't breathe, don't talk, don't make any noise. I was going to get them out.
Saigon has begun.
That morning, there must have been at least 10,000 people ringing the embassy.
There was a sea of people wanting to get out. They looked up at the helicopters leaving, and I could see their eyes, desperate eyes.
There are no words to describe what a ship looks like. It holds 200 and it's got 2,000 of them.
We have no more helicopters. That's it.
As it took off, I could see the group right where we had left them. It was just so serious and deep a betrayal. Who goes? And who gets left behind?
welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, the U.S. Fought in the Vietnam War for nearly 20 years, from 1955 to 1975. And, of course, their alleged role was to stop the spread of communism. But, of course, in this documentary, it doesn't really talk about this aspect of the war. More so, it focuses on the last days of the U.S. troops in Vietnam, as the title of the documentary suggests. And, Dave, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, how would you summarize what Last Days in Vietnam is about, and what was your take on it?
Yeah, as you say, it's a particularly human story. It looks at the, as the title says, the final days of American involvement in 1975 in South Vietnam, and particularly in Saigon. After the withdrawal of troops in 1973, there were still between 5,000 and 7,000 U.S. military personnel or advisors still in South Vietnam, many of them in Saigon. And what the film does is, using archive footage and new interviews, it builds up a portrait of what happened in April 1975 as those U.S. personnel had to scramble to leave the city and the country, and also what they decided to do or not to do to help those people, South Vietnamese and those living in Saigon, who they knew and who they'd been working with, many of them were in relationships with, or who they considered, some of them considered family.
They were very well integrated into the country.
Yeah, absolutely. So some moral dilemmas that come up through that. I found it a pretty gripping film, actually. And it's a micro portrait of this particular chapter in the history of the Vietnam War. I mean, this final chapter is very well put together, and I found it pretty illuminating. Mm.
And Lindsay, if I could turn to you now, would you agree with what Dave said? What was your take on this documentary?
Well, I agree with Dave. I thought it was a very good film, and it got across this sort of moral dilemma very, very well. I think my big criticism of it is not about the film itself, and maybe this shouldn't be a criticism of the film, but that the context of what's going on isn't really developed in the way that it should be. So you see sort of pictures of maps that the North Vietnamese are coming and are surrounding Saigon and are just a few hours away and all this kind of thing, without actually sort of looking at the backstory of what happened. So I think it was it's a very well-made film. It's a very human story, because it's about what happens to the people, which can happen in any war where you're on the losing side, and what then happens, and it can be very, very hard for people in that circumstance, and you can understand why both the Americans wanted to get their friends and family out, and also why some of the South Vietnamese thought that if the North Vietnamese came, they wouldn't have much of a future. Mm-hmm. But I think that lack of context also does weaken the film's message, I suppose, or gives you one side of the message.
Mm. And I want to tear apart, actually, the more on the political context of the film in the next part of the discussion. But just for now, we're going to take a brief break.
Big Chinook showed up. There's no way he can land on Kirk without impacting the ship. He would have killed everybody on this helicopter plus my crew.
It was way too big to land. We thought that the helicopter would just fly away. But as the ship was moving forward, probably 4, 5, 6 knots, something like that, the pilot communicated that he was running low on fuel.
He opened up the port side of the helicopter and he hovered across to the stern, Kirk. Then all of a sudden, here comes a human.
One by one, we jump out. I jumped out, my brother jumped out, my mom was holding my sister. Obviously very scared. And she just, just trustingly, just with one hand, with her right hand, holding on with her left, to brace herself, just dropped my baby sister.
One fellow standing there, and he said he looked up and he saw this big bundle of stuff come flying out, and it was a baby. It was the one-year-old baby. And then the mother jumped out and he caught her too.
There are some really great evacuation stories in this film. And just before we went to that clip, as you were saying, this, from a cinematic perspective, this documentary is a great documentary. And Lindsay, if I could ask you, what evacuation story stood out the most to you?
Well, I liked the whole way that they did it. The thing that perhaps I remember most is this thing where they say that there was this signal which were when they knew they had to evacuate, which would come on the radio, and I forget what the phrase was, but then they said they would play Bing Crosby's White Christmas, which I thought was perhaps one of the most bizarre things in terms of what was going on in Vietnam, the whole war and everything. So I suppose that really stood out. But lots and lots of people trying to get there, the people, and even with that message was the message about White Christmas was you have to come with your family to the embassy with only one suitcase, which I guess is a pretty, I mean, all right, you're getting out, but you're getting out with not very much stuff. So I thought they were very moving. And the one about the man who went and got his family, the Vietnamese pilot who went and got his family in his helicopter and just took the helicopter, went and got his family and got them out. So they were very moving stories, I thought, and they were, you know, obviously people were in a very desperate situation.
Indeed, and according to this documentary, the events described in it includes the stories of some 77,000 South Vietnamese people. And Dave, if I could ask you the same question, what story stood out the most for you?
I mean, I agree. I mean, there's very, very many there. I agree also, actually, yeah, some of those code slogans and things they hear on the radio are, you know, particularly, they do stick in the mind. To be honest, actually, I mean, as well as all the stories of people that do leave, I mean, some of the stories that stick in my mind are the hints of the people that were left behind. I mean, towards the very end of the film, we see some of those very famous images of people clambering over the walls of the US Embassy after the last 11 people are helicoptered away. I mean, one of the many powerful evacuation stories is of the last of the 11 US soldiers are clambering into the helicopter. But there's one person who recalls, a South Vietnamese man who had been a soldier, who recalls how, as soon as he realized, you know, Saigon had fallen, it was over, North Vietnamese were all over the city, and he took off his uniform, got rid of his badge, burnt his military identification card, and just to so he could make it clear that he was just a civilian once again. I think that one story, for me, just sort of powerfully evokes, you know, the idea of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people left behind who would have had to very, very quickly readjust to a different way of life, you know, potentially with the threat of being, you know, of recrimination if they had, you know, if it was proved that they had been collaborating with the Americans or had been in the South Vietnamese army.
And now all these stories are very well, but I just want to challenge sort of this heroic narrative, of course, that many mainstream documentaries about the Vietnam War puts across, especially particularly in this documentary, Lindsay. What do you think of this heroic narrative? I mean, it's not in a vacuum. Did the US soldiers have any business being in Vietnam anyway?
Well, I would argue they didn't, and I think most people now, in terms of the, you know, the 40 years or so since the final fall of Saigon, would argue the same, that it was not a just war, it was an absolutely brutal war, which went on. The French, first of all, fought it because it was their former colony, then the United States came in. And if you look at what they did, the use of chemical weapons in the form of Agent Orange, which caused massive environmental and human damage, it's estimated that 2 million Vietnamese died, 58,000 US soldiers died. And the US soldiers, I mean, the thing that's very missing from this, and probably accurately it's missing because by that time the regular soldiers had gone, but the soldiers themselves killed many of their officers. It was the biggest sort of mutiny or mutinous atmosphere that the Americans ever had to deal with in wartime. And of course, many, many soldiers demonstrated when they were back in the States, were involved in the anti-war movement. It was a mass movement. And none of that, of course, comes across. But there was a great sense that this was an injustice. By the mid-60s, a great sense it was an injustice. And that was reflected not just in the US, in Germany there were huge demos, in Britain, in all of the Western countries. People were very, very much against it.
That was a very powerful point. And Dave, I'd like to pick up on your thoughts on that also in the next part.
When President Ford went before the Congress, he had two major concerns. The first was to save as many people as we could. He cared for the human beings involved. They were not just pawns that once they had lost their military power were abandoned. The second was the honor of America, that we would not be seen at the final agony of South Vietnam as having stabbed it in the back.
Congress wouldn't pass it. They said no more.
You know, no more troops, no more money, no more aid to the Vietnamese. Well, I had to go into President Ford's office to tell him.
Now, Dave, I just wanted to pick up on a point that Lindsay made earlier on before we went to the clip. Would you have liked to have seen more political context to this documentary, perhaps to expose more of the crimes in the area?
I would have. I do think it. I mean, I think it's very good on the micro. It's very good on those final days, those final weeks in Saigon. It's not especially good on the wider context of the war, which, as you said at the very beginning, has spanned two decades. It's not particularly great on the immediate political context, which is hinted at by that clip. Either, I mean, it reduces the background politics to a fairly simple Ford was willing to provide more aid to the South Vietnamese. Congress said no. It does. You mentioned heroism before. I mean, it does point the finger of heroism towards Gerald Ford as well there. Mm-hmm. And obviously Kissinger was in his government at the time, so obviously has, you know, a reason to be pushing that narrative as well. But but at the same time, the film doesn't set out to offer that context. I think I'd have been a bit more dismayed if it offered the context in a more simplistic way, or in a more narrow-minded or biased way. And I think it prefers to avoid it, and prefers just to put you into the melee of those final days, and it does mm-hmm. that well.
Mm-hmm. And Lindsay, following on from that clip, they showed Henry Kissinger, who was in this documentary, and some would accuse him of being a war criminal. How do you think he was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I think he's portrayed very favourably in the documentary, and of course when he says in that clip, you know, we were concerned about human life. I mean, it's a slightly grotesque way to talk about it when you think of how many people had died by the time that he was describing his final evacuation. So I think it's kinder to Kissinger than probably history is or will be to him. I think he played a bad role in all of this. And of course, they kept escalating this war. This is what people forget. It's only in these last years that they de-escalated, and even in 75 they're talking about more money going to prop up what was a puppet government in South Vietnam. You know, I think it's quite unsatisfactory at that level, but perhaps not surprising as well. Once you've got Henry Kissinger to interview, which is quite a coup, then you're not going to ask him any challenging questions, probably.
Mm. And would you agree with that, Dave?
I would. I mean, it would have been interesting to know. I mean, going back to that particular clip there, and again, the film doesn't really set out to offer this context, but it would have been interesting to know more about the reason, why Congress was so opposed to offering more aid at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably partly because in the Vietnam War for the American people had become a massive millstone around the American people's neck, and it was just something that they really wished to put behind them, you know, for many, many valid reasons. But the film doesn't explore that. It leaves those questions begging if you don't bring a lot of knowledge to the film.
Actually, Lindsay, I think that relates to you. I mean, as someone who was inspired into political activism by the Vietnam War, what was the anti-war movement like at that time, and do you think this was affecting Congress's decision?
Well, no, funnily enough, by the time this was happening, the anti-war movement was much weaker than it had been in the late 60s and early 70s, partly because most of the troops had gone, people could see that it was coming to an end. But there was very, very big sentiment against the war, and there was also the point that Dave makes is right, I think, about the politically people were, it was an absolute millstone around their necks. But also by the mid-70s, the world economy had turned towards very serious recession after decades of boom. Mm-hmm. So of course the Americans were also thinking that we can't really afford this. And it's usually accepted that the Vietnam War was a big driver of inflation in the 60s and early 70s, which led to some of this economic crisis. So I think they just thought, you know, let's get out of here. We've, as the Americans quite often do, we've seen this before and since.
And it's a very interesting discussion so far, but we'll just have to pause for now.
I thought of my friends who were killed in action, and I thought, well, is this what we fought for? Is this what the Americans came for? And I didn't have the answer.
I have wrestled with this ever since. I realized that I had become the quintessential American in Vietnam. I had all these causes, all these big things I was doing. I was trying to get the truth back to Washington. I was talking to agents, trying to persuade the ambassador. And I forgot that what was at stake were human lives.
For years after that, I hear that sound in my head, that sound like ch-ch-ch-ch. In the middle of the night, I just jump up. I thought the helicopter come pick me up. I called it Dream in the Wind.
That's absolutely devastating war. Now, Dave, one of the criticisms you can make of this documentary is that the number of people who have died, the casualties from the war is missing. I mean, it's not until 1995 did Vietnam release its official estimate of the death toll, as many as 2 million civilians on both sides and some 1.1 million North Vietnamese and Viet Cong fighters, whereas the U.S. military actually say that between 200,000 and 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers died, so it's a fraction compared to the Vietnamese statistics. Do you think this is a weakness of the documentary also? Would you have liked to have seen this more?
I think the film struggles slightly actually to know how to end and how to conclude, because it doesn't do that. It doesn't wrap up with a summary of, because these events are the final events of the Vietnam War. It could very naturally then have a conclusion which wraps up the entire history of a two decade conflict, but it doesn't do that. And I think I pretty welcome the fact it doesn't, because it would turn it into something else. I mean, it does deal with high-level politics at some points. You know, it deals with decisions that have to be made by U.S. generals and the U.S. ambassador in Saigon, but it does try to bring it back to the experience of more ground-level people on both sides, mm-hmm. You know, or Americans and South Vietnamese, wherever it can. I think if it just gave us a load of figures and statistics at the end, it would be a little bit unfaithful to the film it has been before, really. So I think it tries to end on, as we see there, on a more human, a more sorrowful note, and I think it tries to give a sense of, you know, the futility of war generally on the human level. I'm not sure it does that entirely powerfully. I'm not sure it does that as powerfully as it does as it achieves other things throughout the film, but I think I welcome it trying to end on that note.
Yeah. Which is fair enough, I suppose. And Lindsay, I mean, the US lost at least 58,000 troops, and I've read in my research that this is still a controversial issue as to the US narrative is that they didn't win the war, they didn't lose the war. Why is this such a still controversial issue?
I think it's a very big question still in America. I mean, obviously, the surviving veterans and the surviving anti-war protesters come to that are now older. You know, they're now quite old. They're people who are sort of pensioner age and so on. It's still a very contested thing. There's still a very contested thing. Was it justified? There's still many, many veterans who are disabled and who are mentally and physically ill as a result of the war. And of course, America doesn't like losing wars. I mean, this is Trump's election. You know, he says we don't mind going to war, but we want to be able to win those wars. And of course, Vietnam showed them they couldn't win the wars despite this huge superior air power and military might in general, despite targeting quite deliberately civilians, which they did, who they claimed were sort of hiding the Viet Cong and the people who were fighting. Despite all this, they lost, and they lost because of what the Vietnamese people themselves did. They lost because their own soldiers didn't have the faith in it that perhaps they might have done in previous wars. And they lost because the people at home said, look, we don't want this either. So I think it's still a very big issue in American politics. And, of course, it's contemporary in the sense that there was what was called the Vietnam Syndrome, which did stop these interventions for the best part of 20 years. Mm-hmm. And now we're back with a vengeance with all of those.
Well, it's very great to see how it relates to today as well. And I'm afraid we'll have to leave the discussion here. I wish we could talk longer. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review. We'll be right back.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.